Without further ado, would you help me to welcome Nick Caldwell, please?
Well, I saw Dennis sweating a little bit up here.
There you go. Open the door.
This is the virus that I just gave this computer. Being in my midlife, I've been known to break out in a sweat, regardless of the temperature. Anyways, thanks so much. I just can't thank you enough for taking your weekend to sort of focus on what we've achieved with the Marine Life Protection Act, and specifically to gear up to help educate the general public and users and potential policymakers and folks who can emulate our process elsewhere. So for me, it's just a privilege to be here. And around the room, there are people who could give this presentation. So I beg your indulgence and hope that this, as accurately as possible, reflects what you and I went through in the last 4 years. And I just want to say that really, any talk that I ever give on NLPA is really dedicated to those of you who were the carpenters of the various marine protected areas that we've been building in state waters since 2004. So thank you for your work, and I just am honored to be in your midst. So part of what I was asked to do is just give you a really quick overview of what we know about the state of the oceans, then try to sort of downscale that to our backyard and talk about how that's relevant to the work that we're all doing under the Marine Life Protection Act. Give you a bit of my perspective on the NLPA process, and then sit down so I can listen to the other experts who have been intimately involved in the process as well. So we had two major national commissions, the Pew Ocean Commission and the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, undertake very extensive reviews of what they do about the state of the oceans, and in particular, oceans that bordered the United States and U.S. territories. Back in 2003 and 2004, they each issued their own reports, and not surprisingly, came to dramatically similar conclusions about what was wrong with the oceans and what we needed to do to address the major threats that we're facing the oceans. And fortunately, the Pew Ocean Commission report sort of capsulizes this well in graphics I'm going to borrow from the Pew Ocean report, if you don't mind. But again, these are the very same threats that the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy found as well. First, we have really serious problems with non-point source pollution. And so many of you know who have been working through the Marine Life Protection Act process that that folks wonder, why are we focusing so much on human activities on the water to try to address the health of our oceans, when we know so much of what's happening to our marine and coastal ecosystems is coming from land and human-based activities on the land, including urban runoff, agricultural runoff, marine debris, for example. These are all non-point source pollution. Well, you're right about that, and we can talk a bit about that in a while, but they're a major source of pollution in the ocean in addition to point sources. You know, a lot of us thought that when we passed the Clean Water Act back in the 1990s, that, and since then, we've done so much to clean up our point sources that we really don't have to worry about them so much, but we still have very significant point sources that are affecting our ocean waters, not the least of which are some of the shipping industry and cruise industry. I know some of the cruise industry has been cleaning up its act more recently, but we still have significant deposition of waste, including human waste, into the ocean from the cruise industry. And we still have the deposition of waste, discharge of waste, including human waste, from our publicly owned treatment works. We still have POTWs or sanitation districts, human waste treatment facilities, like the one in San Diego, that discharge something just barely above primary treatment to our ocean water. So barely above the sort of percolation of solids from human waste is getting discharged directly into our ocean waters. And this happens under a waiver under the Clean Water Act. So point sources are not gone, and we still have industrial dumping that takes place as well. Invasive species continue to be just a real thorn in the side of folks who are engaged in marine and coastal ecosystem restoration work and protection work. Everything from, you know, we're familiar with the zebra mussel that's invaded the Midwest pretty extensively, and now we're finding it in our own waters of California. But the mitten crab has been incredible, generated incredible alteration in San Francisco Bay. And the delta areas in particular, and undermining the levee system that we have, but also the elkhorn slough, which is right here in our own backyard, has significant invasive species who have dramatically altered the habitat there. Aquaculture is a really interesting animal because there are so many impacts associated with aquaculture, most of which have to do with how aquaculture is actually prosecuted. When I say that, I mean where it's sited, the management practices that are used, the types of facilities that are put into place, and the types of impacts that are associated with aquaculture range from the direct discharge of the waste products from the animals that are being farmed, and for example, with finfish, their waste products that have an effect not only on the immediate benthic. The bottom of the ocean, right where they're located, the benthic environment. But also, we're finding at Stanford in the fluid dynamics lab that Oliver Fringer and Jeff Kossoff run up at Stanford University, that these waste products don't just deposit directly below these aquaculture pens. They actually travel in plumes in really interesting ways. And depending on the bathymetry of the area, the currents of the area, sort of the hydraulics of the area, whether or not there's a river system present, all of those have a role in determining what happens with those waste products. So they have actually modeled Monterey Bay for hypothetical aquaculture pens and been able to show how the discharge from these pens actually would move in very interesting ways, and in some ways sort of curling up and hugging the coastline, depending on what's going on with the currents and the discharges from this river, for example. Other impacts associated with aquaculture include the fact that aquaculture, finfish aquaculture, and things like carnivores, like salmon, actually take a huge amount of biomass just to generate one farmed fish. So way in excess of the single farm fish that you produce out of an aquaculture facility, you're using far more in terms of tonnage of forage species on which they prey. So we have a net loss of biomass coming out of the ocean supporting this farming activity. There's also an impact associated with predator control frequently in these facilities. Now, not all aquaculture is the same, and we're most familiar down here with shellfish aquaculture, and certainly in California, that is, mariculture is our primary form of aquaculture, and it's largely shellfish. So with shellfish, they are filter feeders. We tend to get some water quality improvements in many cases associated with these facilities, but there are also impacts associated with them depending on, again, the type of facility that's used, how the shellfish are actually grown, whether there's bottom contact associated with that facility or not, and things of that nature. Coastal development, well, that goes without saying. And here in California, we're so fortunate because we have the California Coastal Act. It was actually adopted in 1976, so we've had, you know, almost going four decades of experience in pretty heavy regulation of our coastal development, and still we have dramatic effects associated with coastal development here, ranging from sedimentation to habitat alteration to habitat removal. We're down to something around maybe 10, maybe less than 10% of our coastal wetlands in California. And it's taking its toll everywhere. We are not alone. We have the, people say the nation's most powerful land use regulatory agency in the Coastal Commission. Well, if that's true, and we're failing at protecting our coastal resources, then what are all the other states doing? Habitat alteration, they placed it in a category of its own because so many things contribute to habitat alteration. I've already mentioned some. Aquaculture itself can, invasive species can, certainly pollution of certain sorts can. But also certain fishing gear can significantly alter the habitat depending on the type. And derelict deer, a gear, for example, sort of goes off and fishes on its own and can be disruptive as well. Trawling is a particularly destructive form of fishing that results in fairly significant habitat alteration. Bycatch, of course, that is it can be associated with many different forms of fishing. We, in California, we've been very sensitive to long lining in particular. It has dramatic impacts on some of our sort of our most important pelagic species, not the least of which are our ocean-going sea turtles, and also on our seabirds. The albatross, for example, is pretty dramatically impacted by long lines. And then climate change. We have this awful trio of direct impacts associated with climate change. Sea warming itself, we have problems with, of course, different species. And what we're finding, and some of the research that's come, that has come out of Halpin's Marine Station and George Somera, for example, the most recent former director of Hopkins, found that many of the species in the intertidal live on the very edge of their temperature range, their sort of tolerable temperature range. And when you get significant warming, as we do with climate change, those species can no longer survive in their normal habitat. Now, some of these species may be able to move to an area that has slightly more moderate temperatures. Other species will not be able to move. And one of the interesting things that has been proposed by marine ecologist and ornithologist Terry Root, who is up at Stanford, is that we're now entering a stage where we're going to have to start triaging species. And she's proposing that we really do have to think about that. And that's, we're already playing God on an ad hoc basis, but her idea is that we actually have to think very carefully about which species, with limited resources, which species we really need to be particularly targeting for attempting to say that which species we just need to let go. Sobering thought. So these two reports came out in 03 and 04. And there really wasn't much action on the national scene at all. And in fact, that was one of the things that those two reports highlighted, that there's a real lack of leadership on the national level for doing anything about the oceans and the conditions that we find them in. And there were sort of nice sort of incubated activities going on at the state level, but they still required some support. And certainly we needed to support regional efforts that looked like they were burgeoning, but we still have in 2006, the Joint Ocean Commission Initiative actually issued a report. And what happened is you had members of the Pew Ocean Commission and members of the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy join forces with the Joint Ocean Commission Initiative. And now they are issuing regular reports, including report cards, on how the nation, states, and regions are performing on the recommendations that were made in the Pew Ocean Commission report and the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy. And this 2006 report confirms our oceans and coasts are still in trouble. We have not made any significant progress in addressing the threats that we two commissions identified in our last reports, and immediate action is necessary. So one of the things, and of course, we at Stanford and at Inbari and at the Monterey Bay Aquarium took that charge very seriously. Each of us in our own way, of course, are trying to attack the different problems that were identified in these two reports. But what we recognized is that between and among us, we had pretty significant expertise across the disciplines. Stanford and all different forms of marine biology, marine ecology, oceanography, economics, law and policy, for example, in Bari and deep sea exploration, and engineering, and increasingly in marine ecology, marine biology, and now in the social sciences, and then the Monterey Bay Aquarium and public education and outreach, and its incredible ability to reach people and motivate them to take action for conservation, that we should join forces. And so we did that. We put together a proposal which was funded by the Packard Foundation initially. We received a $25 million grant from the Packard Foundation as seed funding. And our core purpose, as Dennis explained, was to really elevate the impact of the sciences, natural, physical, and social sciences on ocean policy. And to do it together, to do it in an interdisciplinary way, and to be focused on policy-relevant problems, and to work with the policy realm, to work with the NGOs, to work with the business community and the government community on practical solutions, and to help them develop strategies that will that show great promise of actually working. So that is our focus, and that's kind of a tall order, so naturally we wanted to focus ourselves a little bit. We've chosen three sort of focal substantive areas to work in. One is climate change, the second is land-sea interactions, and the third is marine and coastal ecosystem health. Well, between those three, you pretty much cover everything, so we kept our options open. And we went public in January. That's in the sort of pejorative sense of going public. We went public with the fact that we had formed and that we were going to be opened up for business. And since then, we've received tons of great ideas about what we should be doing. We developed some criteria for how to sort through those ideas while we're still engaged between and among ourselves and in our implementation planning and figuring out where we have the most expertise and the most promise of delivering some good solutions. But we have sort of a starter set of projects that we've already undertaken and are moving forward on. And I'm going to talk a little bit about one of them, and it's our most ambitious project right now, and that is one that's focused on the Pacific Ocean. And we're calling it POI, or the Pacific Ocean Initiative. The genesis of this initiative really was in our being contacted at the very beginning of the year by the governor's office and the Ocean Conservancy, who had been in, I think, one or two conversations about the governor wanting to do something that reached across the Pacific Ocean to nation-state leaders from around the Pacific and certainly across the Pacific to do something concrete for our own backyard, for this natural resource that we share, this public trust resource that we shared with New Zealand and Australia and Hawaii and Micronesia and Asia and Alaska and Russia. And so they contacted us and they said, we'd really like to do something. We're thinking about something like an action plan similar to what we did with climate change, with AB 32. And for those of you who aren't familiar with AB 32, because I live and breathe in the world of talking about SBs and ABs, it's the climate change law that we passed a few years ago. It was sponsored by Fran Pavley and who's the other? It was a bipartisan effort, let's put it that way. And the point of it was to reduce California's greenhouse gas emissions down to 1990 levels by the year 2020. So it set this really firm target that the state of California had to achieve. And of course, this is a major step in addressing climate change, the first of which would be mitigating, reducing our emissions. And then the second part of addressing climate change is figuring out how we can best adapt to the changes that are already taking place. So the governor's office was interested in something similar to this. They wanted to know what the targets should be for the Pacific Ocean. And we turned back to our scientific community, and the answer we got was, well, we don't know exactly.
exactly what the target should be. That is something that would require some work, some homework. We can't tell you right off the bat exactly what the targets would be. We have, our intuition tells us what we need to be doing, but we're not sure whether we can instantly create metrics that would produce the results that we can rely on for making significant progress on the major threats that we think are operating in the Pacific. And we looked around and there was no single report that really told us what is going on in the Pacific Ocean. So what we did is, and simultaneously we understood that there was an effort going on with the IUCN, the International Union of Conservation for Nature, which is this amazing international group of individual scientists, IGOs, intergovernmental organizations, NGOs, non-governmental organizations, governments, and folks who are engaged in conservation in all sectors, not just the oceans. Their marine program was starting to focus on the Pacific Ocean too, and they also wanted to develop some group of targets that nation states around the Pacific could then agree to achieving. So we all came together as a result of our learning that we were interested in the same thing. And the Center for Ocean Solutions, I sat down at breakfast with Julia Lefebvre, who's the Director General of the IUCN. And I told her that we had come to the conclusion that what we needed to do is review what the science told us about the Pacific, and that from that we needed to move towards targets. But first we had to undertake a rapid review of what the science said. And only then would any sort of policy be deemed credible, and we rely on that policy as really being linked to the primary threats that face the Pacific. So we agreed, and I undertook to work with a group of scientists to review all the literature that we could find that relates to the Pacific Ocean, distill it, synthesize it, and then from there move towards a scientific consensus statement which capsulizes what the key threats are facing the Pacific and suggests what some viable solutions are for dealing with it. So we ended up taking a map of the Pacific and using an altered version of the UN's view of the Pacific Ocean, and we learned by actually talking directly with scientists who were particularly in this area that the map that the UN uses, which would use the equator as a territory divider, was not really accurate. So we ended up drawing a specialized map, and we ended up undertaking that literature review that I discussed. So we reviewed over 3,420 peer-reviewed articles and peer-reviewed government publications. Each one was read fully. We then synthesized the information that was contained in there by threats, impacts, research gaps, and trends, and organized that country by country, region by region, and Pan-Pacific. What resulted from that was what we're calling a meta-analysis. That's a common term used in science parlance, which is really a synthetic report based on a review of all scientific knowledge in a given area. And that synthetic report is about 160 pages long, and it has all sorts of neat features, which we can talk about. We're hoping to publish it in final form at the end of this month. And we took that meta-analysis and then brought together a group of 30 scientists representing 30 countries, or over 30 countries in some cases where we had people with dual citizenship. We brought them together in a two-day workshop in Honolulu in August. So remember, we started this process at the beginning of the year. I met with Julia from IUCN in March, and then we got to going on this review of the literature. In August, we pulled the scientists together in Honolulu for 2 days with a draft version of that meta-analysis. And the purpose of bringing together the scientists was to do a couple of things. First, we thought it was powerful in and of itself in just convening a group of scientists from across the Pacific to forge a community of scientists to be focused on our common resource. It's never been done before. and to pull people from their own countries, not just to use Anglos for this effort, not just to use people from Stanford or Embari or the aquarium for this effort, but to take people from their own regions who had undertaken with awesome science in their own areas, pull them together and have them ground truth that meta-analysis and tell us about additional resources that we should be aware of. And then to go through the meta-analysis, and most of them focused in their own areas. A few of them read the entire thing in great detail, but most people focused in their own areas and really walk us through what the key threats were there that they knew about. And we also talked about hotspots as a result, sort of what the sort of major alarming threats were in their own areas. But the purpose of bringing them together, too, was to say, what can we say collectively about the threats that are facing the Pacific everywhere? Every single corner of the Pacific is affected by a few things. What are those few things? And maybe with that kind of common cause, common sense of urgency and threat, we can then build a foundation for nation states to agree to some form of call to action. So in the course of doing this lit review, we realized there's no single place you can go to for scientific findings on the Pacific, so we built one. And it's called the Pacific Ocean Library. You can get it on our website. It's a fully searchable internet-based tool. We are committed to keeping it up to date on some form of regularity. We're still figuring out how often we'll be able to update that. But it's a great tool. This is just what our consensus statement looks like right now. You can get to it on the web by going through our website or koi.stanford.edu. And this is what it does. It identifies the four top threats that we found that were absolutely pervasive and pose sort of the greatest threat moving forward. That these were consistently dominant threats across the Pacific. And of course, as I already mentioned, we wanted this to serve as a foundation for policy change. So the four threats should now be familiar with you, since we've already looked at several of these from the last two big ocean reports: pollution, habitat destruction, overfishing, and climate change. Let's just run through them very briefly. So pollution, we've already talked about nutrient pollution, either from human waste or from agricultural activities, marine debris, toxic dumping, urban runoff. These really ended up being the dominant pollutants. And one thing that struck us in going through the scientific literature is that human waste is really a big issue across the Pacific. And for my money, if I were looking at this and I could just, you know, wave a wand, and I would definitely address human sanitation across the Pacific. And you know, that's actually something we know how to do. We know how to do it at very different scales. It's not a matter of the technology, it's really a matter of capacity building and financing it and seeing it through. Because it certainly would have an enormous impact on not only our marine and coastal systems, but also on public health. Then habitat destruction, that I've talked about the destructive fishing, the land-based coastal development that really has an impact. A lot of poor agricultural practices, including aquaculture, which involve reclamation of land, particularly in Asia, where there's a lot of aquaculture that's taking over mangrove areas. And even industrial wastewater can actually have dramatic effects on our coral reefs, which is a form of habitat destruction. Overfishing was really interesting. This surprised me a little bit. What we found is that every single form of fishing, recreational fishing, artisanal fishing, and commercial fishing, was resulting in overexploitation of species across the Pacific. The fact that we had folks from very small countries, Palau, Papua New Guinea, Micronesia, and Hawaii, where artisanal fishing and subsistence fishing are very, very common, these scientists said, oh yeah, Absolutely, we know it. We know that even artisanal fishing and subsistence fishing can result in pretty serious impacts. And one example of how that works in combination with climate change, which we'll get to in a second, is where you have the combination of sea warming and coral bleaching, and the or you have the combination of nutrient pollution with excessive algae growing in coral reefs and removal of herbivores, it's a double whammy for that reef system. So often the overfishing, climate change, pollution, habitat destruction are operating synthetically in combination with one another to have really profound impacts. And finally, climate change, we already talked about the three major impacts, and here the concern was that those impacts are exacerbating all of these other stressors, and that it's projected to get worse. And certain countries with sea level rise are going to completely disappear. Kiribati, for example, a lot of those atolls they're gone. That results in pretty significant cultural displacement and climate change refugees. And the loss of habitat too. Some coral reefs we're finding seem to be a little bit more resilient than others. Some can continue to grow and we think may be able to keep some pace with sea level rise, but others will not necessarily be able to, particularly those that are already suffering the results of climate change and habitat destruction, these other stressors. So what are we going to do with this information? Well, we're going to publish that meta-analysis. We think it will be a very powerful tool. There'll be some derivative publications that we hope to take from it and publish independently. One of them certainly will be on research gaps so that we can help inform NSF and the major foundations about where we still need some more information. But others will be really focused on key threats in particular areas and the process that we use, because we think this is a process that could be duplicated or emulated in some way, shape, or form for the other oceans. The IUCN is actually moving ahead. They plan to issue a report on the Pacific, the scientific foundation for which is our meta-analysis, but they'd like to do something kind of like the Stern Report, which discusses the cost of doing nothing, and to sort of further undergird this this foundation for a action plan that leaders around the Pacific can agree to or will feel motivated to agree to. One of the suggested solutions that we came up with from that two-day workshop, and that certainly has been suggested in the scientific literature as well, is the idea of forming a conservation trust for the Pacific Ocean. Conservation trusts are a pretty well-known device. There are lots of, there's a new report that just came out that kind of gathers together the best policies, best practices of conservation trusts. And one of the things that we think we could help contribute to is thinking through, if you're going to do a Pacific-wide conservation trust, what that might look like, what some of the best forms might look like, and what some good alternatives would be, and key features of that trust. Also, we know that we managed to pull together this core group of scientists, and now we really want to nurture that group so that they can continue to serve in their individual capacities in their own regions, but also collectively as a voice for the Pacific. And all of this is going to culminate in the year 2010 with the California World Ocean Conference, where we plan to work with the state of California to bring together like a Davos-like heads of state, where hopefully we'll be ready with some of those metrics that I discussed, targets, that they will then be able to commit to in 2010. So how does this all relate to MLPA and the creation of marine protected areas? And I have a little time left. How long? Okay, so, some of it will be obvious to you, but among the things that we've learned over the last decade and plus is that there's a rich tradition of actually establishing marine protected areas all over the world. Scientists got together, PESCO was a key convener here, and looked at 124 marine reserves. These are full, no-take marine protected areas, and looked at how those reserves were or were not making any difference at all in terms of ocean health. And looked at the scientific literature, the studies that have been done on these marine reserves. And what they found are pretty significant results. They found that there are significant increases in biomass, in the density of species, in the size of those species, and the diversity of those species across temperate and tropical ranges. This was, of course, the degree to which these different features of the ecosystem were able to flourish depended on what activities were going outside the reserve and various other factors. But nonetheless, the evidence was in that you still can experience really significant increases in these four key features of a marine system within a reserve. And they also found that there are potentially significant effects of marine reserves for outside of the reserve. There's certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence of fishermen fishing the line, picking up really large species or individuals just outside these marine reserves, and an abundance of fish in some cases just outside these reserves. But they also were able to document that many of the things that were happening inside the reserves, some of which were spilling over outside the reserves, made these areas that benefited from the special protection sort of well-suited to be very resilient against those stressors and threats that we just discussed, particularly climate change. When you are in a more robust state as a marine or coastal ecosystem, you're better able to withstand the shocks associated with these other stresses, and you're better able to rebound from those shocks. So we've learned a lot, and it was experiences like this. This is taken from the brand new Marine Reserves booklet that I think I saw a bunch of you looking at, so I think you have it, which is great. We learned that in California about these as well, and even as early as 1999, when a statute, the MLPA, was passed. And it was really this experience that I think gave rise to the idea of, heck, let's be systematic about putting in some of these marine protected areas in our state waters and see if we can realize some of these benefits that are accruing all over the world. So just quickly, sort of, I want to give you a before and after of MLPA, because it really was a dramatic shift in ocean policy in this state. Was before it, we had this sort of incoherent assemblage of MPAs that had been put into place for a whole variety of reasons, some based on cultural reasons, some based on scientific research desires, some based on clear conservation motivation, but there was no sort of clear overriding logic to how these marine protected areas had been put into place. There was no information or system for determining their efficacy, things of that nature, no way to sort of monitor them over time, and to be accountable to ourselves about whether these MPAs were achieving what we thought we were achieving when we put them in place in the first place. Furthermore, we had a system where if you wanted to get a marine protected area in state waters, you had to petition the Fish and Game Commission to get that marine protected area in place. The burden was on the public or the scientific community to prove that we needed this MPA. And in many cases, we had a fisheries management system that was really at cross purposes with the Endangered Species Act, with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and itself in some cases. And there was no clear effort to really integrate ecosystem principles, how ecosystems function, what contributes to the health of the Rainier Coastal System and its ongoing functioning, so all the processes that make it work. So with a combination of MLPA and MLMA, the Marine Life Management Act, we had this dramatic shift where the burden was now placed on the state to create a network of marine protected areas in state waters that our fisheries managers had to address ecosystem protection writ large, and that sort of put us way ahead of everybody else in terms of what was going on across the states. The goals of the Marine Life Protection Act are pretty stunning for the fact that they are really focused on ecosystem health, protecting diversity and the functioning, restoring marine life populations, improving recreational, educational, and study opportunities, protecting these some unique habitats, and included in that are natural heritage sites, places that are just outstanding for their intrinsic value. And finally, making sure that we had some clear objectives and some effective management in place so that we could see how these things were performing over time and we could have some metrics in place to sort of score them in a way and to assess whether or not they really were doing what we thought what we're hoping that they will do. Finally, ensuring that they service the network. Now, these six goals, all but this one here, actually, and even this one, has pretty significant implications for the science. But all the other five are absolutely clearly within the realm of the scientific community, even this one, because we're talking about potential research opportunities. So at its foundation, this really required a solid scientific contribution. And the Act itself asked for, in order to implement the law and achieve these goals, to use the best readily available science. And the key word there is best and readily. So the Act doesn't say if you find that there are some sort of gaps in the science that you should hold off making any decisions, you should engage in additional research. It basically says, now you convene the scientific community, you find out what we know about how to achieve these various goals, and go with what you have. In the face of uncertainty, go with what you have, make the decisions on MPAs and appropriate networks, and it has within it the ability to revisit those decisions over time, so as the scientific community produces more information, we'll be able to incorporate that information over time with an adaptive management process. So, of course, there are sort of three primary types of marine protected areas that we can implement with the Marine Life Protection Act: no-take reserves, marine parks where some form of recreational fishing is allowed, but no commercial fishing is allowed, or marine conservation areas where you can have some combination, potentially, of both recreational and commercial fishing. Now, you may ask, okay, Meg, you showed us all those other stressors. Why is the Marine Life Protection Act just focused on basically whether you can fish or not, and which kind of fishing you can undertake? Well, the Marine Life Protection Act, key authority there is the Fish and Game Commission. And the Fish and Game Commission's authority really rests with controlling fishing activities and aquaculture, by the way, including things like kelp harvesting. So it's partly an artifact of who gets to implement the Marine Life Protection Act. And that authority resides with the Fish and Game Commission. They have control over the extraction of marine resources. And that's just the way it is. But as we already know from what we've learned about marine reserves and what we already know about the compounding effects of these different stressors, even the sort of regulation of fishing in and out of certain areas and geographically specific areas can have significant impacts on our marine and coastal ecosystems and their ability to rebound and their ability to be resilient over time in the face of these other stressors, for which we have laws to address those. So that's sort of an example of how I talk about the fact that we are talking largely about biomass extraction when we are implementing the Marine Life Protection Act, and where you can conduct certain activities and where you can't. So it's not a fisheries management law, but we're using control of human activities in geographically specific areas to try to promote ecosystem health. And again, we're going with the science that we have. There were some previous attempts to implement the law. This is maybe being a little rough, but anyways, we had an attempt in 2001, a fair amount of resource there, but a process that really, it kept the scientists in a vacuum. It engaged the scientific community, but it cordoned them off from the public process. And that was a mistake. So we learned from that attempt at implementation that's not the way to go. You have to integrate the scientists, and you have to improve scientific literacy among all the decision makers and participants in implementing this law to make it a really effective public process that people will have confidence in. So in 2002, we had another attempt, but unfortunately not the kind of financial resources that we needed to pursue this much more robust public process. And then in 2004, with a combination of public and private funding, that culminated in a memorandum of understanding between the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation and the Department of Fish and Game and the Resources Agency, we had a process that was very robust. A lot of people say it's the most robust and transparent public process they've ever seen anywhere, and that it creates a dangerous standard. Everybody else is going to be compared. But that MOU inflicted deadlines. We'd already passed the deadlines that were contained in the statute. It imposed new deadlines. It expressed strong political will for making this happen. And again, this amazing process that now I think is just, the bee's knees. So here's just a graphical representation of the process, flanked by an independent staff, initiative staff on the left, that includes representatives from the Department of Fish and Game, but also includes sort of the outside, if you will, it's a sort of a special staff that is absolutely formed just to implement the Marine Life Protection Act and to support these different bodies here all along the process in their review of the scientific literature, their review of the socioeconomic information that's relevant, and their development of potential alternative marine protected area networks, and their recommendation to the Fish and Game Commission, ultimately, who makes the decision under the Marine Life Protection Act. And the general public is involved from the very beginning to the very end. Everything is web streamed, lock, stock, and barrel. This thing is as transparent as it gets. I talked about the science advisory team that we had for the South Central Coast area, which is our area right here. Was comprised of 28 scientists ranging in disciplines. We did have at least one economist on that team, and really ranging in their sort of their perspectives on how something like this might be implemented. So it was I would say, sort of like a blue ribbon science advisory team that was put together. Ultimately, it was put together by the Department of Fish and Game in consultation with MLPA staff and the chair of our Blue Ribbon Task Force that I served on. The scientific advisory team did something that was really key. What they did is they really distilled the scientific knowledge on how marine protected areas could be designed, both individually and as a network, and they reduced that information to these rules of thumb. And it was just a really sort of breakthrough to have the science advisory team do this, because these are very concrete hooks that the stakeholders could use in figuring out how to start to design these networks of marine protected areas. And each of these criteria or suggested criteria has a significant amount of science behind it. Things like, you know, how larvae disperse and how far they disperse. Taking a whole collection of marine species that were intended to benefit from the establishment of marine protected areas and looking at what their adult ranges were, for example, help determine what the size would be and the larval dispersal, what the spacing should be. And habitat coverage, well, that was involved an extensive amount of mapping, some of which already exists and some of which had to get undertaken very quickly to just understand what habitats do we have, how do we have a representative number of habitats and types of habitats within our network, and then making sure that we had replication not only for scientific purposes so that we can study these and really understand if the results that we are getting are scientifically significant, but also for the purposes of resiliency, because if one of these MPAs gets hit by an oil spill, for example, there'll be other areas that are supposed to be serving sort of that same purpose. So we went from these a collection of 12 marine protected areas covering, you know, less than 4%, and only 5 marine reserves, full no-take reserves, to 29 marine protected areas with just under, well, almost verging on 8% in no-take reserves. We did learn a few things from our Central Coast process, many of you were part of and helped us see the light. And one was that using that task force model was probably a pretty good one. The members of the Blue Ribbon Task Force were appointed by the Resources Secretary. We were meant to be sort of a depoliticized group who could really engage on policy and provide direction, but weren't going to be hostage to any particular perspective or that, you know, we had shown an ability to somehow look at science and make tough resource decisions in the past. And so we're going to stick with that model because everybody thought it was worked pretty well. We were able to think more clearly about how our different parts would engage with each other. And in particular, we developed some ideas about how each of those different parts of that flowchart that I showed you, each of the agencies and the task force and the stakeholders and the scientists, could better integrate and get better communications flowing between and among us so that there were no surprises in the process moving forward. And involving the Fish and Game Commission, the ultimate arbiters in the process earlier, so that they were engaged and they were getting that benefit of scientific literacy at the same time as the rest of us and could really understand that incredibly intense process that all of us were going through. Also thinking about how do we increase the capacity of our sister agencies or the sister agencies to better engage in the process too. So this is an example of what I view as a new graphic for the North Central Coast, where we had a lot better communication going on between the stakeholder group and the Department of Fish and Game, which has some clear technical interests in how MPAs are put together, enforcement in particular, and the science advisory team has a lot more communication and opportunities to help raise scientific literacy and engage with the Fish and Game Commission as well. This shows you just how close the final packages were with the North Central Coast, which is our next one. The Fish and Game Commission hasn't yet ruled on our recommendation for the North Central Coast, which was the integrated preferred alternative. I always think it's the IPAs, India, Pale Ale, but you know, that's what they came up with. And this just shows you the array that we came up with the North Central Coast. So I'm going to end there so that we can maybe do a few questions. And thank you so much. I'm sorry to go on. So I don't know. Can we turn the Any comments or questions?
Mine's a real simple one. We went over the site where we can find out about identifying the 4 most serious threats real fast, and we get to write it down.
Oh, okay. So you can just go to poi.stanford.edu, poi.stanford.edu.
In the pollution area, is there any credence to that story that there's this great Pacific garbage patch out there in
South
of Texas with all kinds of plastic stuff?
Absolutely. The North Pacific Gyre, yeah. Yes.
Is there any specific kinds of programs to deal with that?
Oh my gosh. So, well, there are organizations that are specifically focused on that, and actually California is launching an initiative to address the contribution of plastics to the ocean and thinking about ways of reducing our plastic usage and ways that we can actually curb discharge to the ocean. And places like, if you can believe it, Los Angeles County actually passed a major bond measure, something like that, a few years ago. And they are engaging in the wholesale retrofitting of their whole storm system and in installing a number of things and collectors that will actually capture some of this stuff before it runs off into the ocean. So yes, there are some efforts underway. You know, and you'd think you could just go out there with a big vacuum or something. And I guess it's just not that simple. A lot of these pieces are floating just below the surface, and so it's, you know, I keep waiting for someone to say, we are heading out there, you know, we're taking Ross Perot's money and we're going to do this. But I don't know exactly what's going on, but ever to think about it, to collect it right there. It's an enormous problem. A lot of these plastics look just like food. So the albatross, for example, end up feeding this stuff to their young. Every single albatross carcass that is collected and necropsies are performed on it, their stomachs are full of plastics. They create the illusion of being full, so these animals starve to death. We've got marine mammals who show up here in Monterey Bay who are strangled to death. And so they're just, it's a disgusting story that, you know, our excessive use of plastics has resulted in this. There are a lot of people who are now, taking very seriously the abandonment of single serve plastic anything.
Do you ever use tegula umbrellas and tegula brunia for indicators of thermal regulation of the climate change?
Tegula what?
Turbid snails.
Pardon?
Turbid snails. Brown and black.
Oh, turbid snails. There was one on the slideshow. Yeah. Well, I personally don't. But I know scientists who do use turbid snails. I don't know how to answer your question. I'm sorry. I am a lawyer, really. I try to master the science as much as I possibly can, but I can't answer that question. I'm sorry. I know that we're using barnacles up and down the state. The Columbia Lab has been doing this. They've been surveying the barnacles up and down the state. And I don't know about turbid snails. Sorry.
Do you see some opportunities for leverage with these are very localized efforts here for MPAs and the specific ocean initiative in terms of resulting in some tangible on the ground?
I do, and there already are regional efforts, particularly in the South Pacific, the Phoenix Islands, there's the Micronesia Challenge around Palau, and there are actually the use of marine protected areas goes way back with traditional communities, and the Raui, R-A-U-I, is a form of marine protected area that has been used in the Southern Pacific for generations and generations. But there are regional efforts that basically are focused on the imposition of marine protected areas having a certain percentage of their waters. So that kind of prototype is already in place, and then looking at how we've done it here, I think can greatly inform those efforts, but also can help us think more collectively about whether or not some kind of percentage set aside is appropriate. It's, you know, this, it's tricky stuff. It's very controversial in California to think about percentages. You know, we touched on that briefly with MLPA and kind of got away from thinking about hard percentages for certain things. But there, you know, the scientific literature does suggest that these MPAs tend to be more effective if they're within a certain percentage range. And so we'll look forward to more of that coming out and seeing how, you know, MPA networks like the Channel Islands are performing, where you have the vast majority of them are marine reserves, covering a certain percentage of those waters, and it's just in its infancy. So, you know, a lot of these species live so long, 60, 120 years, it's going to take a really long time for us to see whether or not there are significant benefits flowing from them. It takes just sometimes a couple years to wipe them out, but, you know, it's going to take a while to allow them to rebound. Other species tend to rebound more quickly. The spiny lobster, for example, is doing really well in areas in the Channel Islands. So we just have to be patient. And I think we do have to think about things like that. What is the science telling us? Is there a rule of thumb there that we could use across the Pacific?
That's it.